Can I have a few volunteers just to read? We'll be reading some of these passages, and I think with so many chapters, it's good to actually read through some of this. So I'll need 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 volunteers. 5. Okay. Ezekiel 14:12-14. Jeff. Tim, James 5:10-11. 3 more. Okay, Dee Dee, Job 1:6-12. Ezekiel 14:12-14, right. Okay, Josiah, chapter 2:1-10. You got a long one there. And then one last person. Brian, all right, thank you. Chapters 2:11-13 in Job. Okay, great, thank you. And I'll call on you guys when the time comes to that. Okay, so if I were to ask you guys, associate one word with the book of Job, what would you guys say? If someone just asked you, what's the book of Job about? Give me only maybe one word. Is that hard? That's a good word. Okay, theodicy. You want to explain what that means to everybody?
God's righteousness
and human suffering. Yeah, okay. So justifying God's character in the midst of suffering. Okay, that's a good one. I don't think most people would use that word, but that's great. Anyway, so I think suffering is a big one, right? Most people think about Job, suffering, all that stuff. And so basically, it's safe to say that if you're human, you will suffer at some point. And so, we all kind of wrestle with this topic, some point or other, whether it be our own suffering or someone else's suffering. And I think one of the biggest questions that is posed here in the book of Job is, why does God allow innocent people to suffer? Now, think about for a second in your own head how you would answer that question. Just don't answer out loud, but just think about, why does God allow innocent people to suffer? My guess is, in this room here, I guess there's a lot of well-taught Christians, and I bet some people here might say something like, well, Chinwe, there's actually no innocent person at all. Romans 3:23, for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. So the question of why does God allow innocent people to suffer is, God doesn't allow innocent people to suffer because there are no innocent people. Well, that could be true. That is true, but it just kind of sidesteps the question, actually, right? So this book is not debating whether there are anybody that's sinless. We all know everybody's sinful, and Job himself in the book actually addresses that. He knows that he is sinful. But what this book is about is just dealing. Well, what's interesting about Job's situation is that God himself declares Job as righteous and upright. And so that's a very interesting thing. He himself says that. And so the question then later is, well, if so, then why would God allow him to suffer, right? And so the book is kind of centered around this question, and we'll try to get an answer by the end of next week, and we'll touch on parts of it today. So let me just give you guys a little bit of book background here. It's written, the date of the book is uncertain when it was written, but probably around 2000 to 1700 B.C., so that's around the time of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, that time. And they base that on a few facts, and I'll just name two of them. One is that Job, if you look at the end of the book, he lived to estimate about 200 years old. And so basically before that, in the old early Genesis, people lived till 800, 900 years old. And then after the flood, the lifespan decreased, and eventually it went down to about 120 or so. So Job being about 200 years old, they estimate, okay, it's probably around the time of the patriarchs, about how old Abraham lived to. And other thing we'll read soon is that Job had priestly functions in his own family, so there wasn't an official priesthood yet. And so you look in chapter 1 where he's sacrificing for his family, and so that's kind of how they speculate approximately where this book of Job was written. Who wrote the book of Job? We really don't know. There are guesses that it might be Moses, because Moses lived in Midian for about 40 years, and Midian is close by to this area, this land of Uz, and so they speculate Moses might have been, and again, around the time of the patriarchs and everything. Another possibility is Solomon. Solomon, we know that wrote a lot of the other wisdom literature, right? Certain Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, obviously. And so this fits right in there with that. And so there are speculations that it is. But the short answer really is we don't know. And so we can speculate, but we're just not sure. The setting, as I have already said, is in the land of Uz. And I put this little map in there for you guys just to get a little reference. Now, you can see Israel is kind of like just a little bit west of the center of the map there. And you can see that little brighter circle area. That's kind of the land of Uz. And that's kind of where it takes place. And so what's interesting to note about this is Job himself was not an Israelite, right? So we look at the beginning of Genesis, the first five books of the Bible. A lot of it's talking about the formation of the tribe of Israel. But Job himself was not an Israelite. And he was likely part of this, like I said, Uz, which is part of Edom. So if you guys have some Genesis history, there was Isaac, had two sons, right? Jacob and Esau. Jacob became known as who? What's his other name? Jacob? Israel, right? And then Esau, he had another name. You guys know what that is? Edom. So he was Edom. So his descendants were the Edomites, okay? So they were both had kind of the patriarch in common. But so the Edomites were descended from Isaac too, but they were not Israelites. But Job, even though he was an Israelite, he did fear God. He did fear Yahweh. And so that was very interesting. So let's read a little bit about Job. Let's turn to chapter 1, and I'll have Josh read for us Job chapter 1, verses 1 through 5, just our introduction into Job. Thank you. So what are some things that we learn about Job in the first five verses here? Okay, yeah, he's blameless and upright. He had the upright character. What else? Yeah. Oh, Jeff.
He was wealthy.
Yeah, wealthy, right? Had a lot of possessions. I mean, 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, that's a lot, and a lot of other things, right? Yeah, Tim?
Even the phrase in verse 1, he hears that God
had turned away to Jehovah. That's in Proverbs 3. Is that exact? Yeah, that's very good. Any others?
He had a lot of kids,
right? And the very, you know, in that culture and day when you have kids, it was a blessing. And then 7 is kind of like a good, perfect number for sons, and they say 10 is like also, you know, 10 total kids was like another perfect number. So it was just, he was blessed, right, in that sense. We don't want to look too much into that symbolism, but basically he was blessed with possessions, family, everything. And so we find about him that his character is, his positive side is he was blameless, he was upright, and he is on the, you could say the negative side, meaning what he didn't do was he didn't commit. I mean, he was not evil, right? He turned away from evil. So he actively spurned evil. So he was a very righteous man. Like Tim said, he's like the optimal Proverbs man. And then in the Bible, there's not too many mentions of Job. There are two other places, one in the Old Testament, one in the New Testament. So we'll just briefly cover those. We're not going to delve too much into it, but Jeff, if you can read for us Ezekiel 14:12-14.
The word of the Lord came against me, saying,
Son of Man, when the land comes against me, by persistent unfaithfulness, I will stretch out my hand against it. I will cut off its supply of bread, send famine on it, and cut off man and beast from it. Even if these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they would deliver only themselves by their righteousness, said the Lord God.
Thank you. Yeah, so if you hear that last few words there, you know, these men would deliver them by their righteousness, right? So this passage is upholding, again, Job's righteousness. So that's one passage there. And then in the New Testament, there's one passage as well. So let's have Tim read that, James 5, 10 to 11. Thank you. So in that passage, we hear about Job's steadfastness, right? And so as we read through this book, we can see how tough it is for Job to maintain his composure, how he continues to maintain his integrity. And so this commends him for his steadfastness. So if you guys want to, in the outline, if you're following the outline, we're on the second page now, but just some notable observations about this book. It's really interesting. The first two chapters, which we'll cover most of today, and the epilogue, which is just the last eight verses of this book, is all in prose form. So prose form means like narrative, kind of like how you read a story. Like as we've just read the first five verses, right? It's kind of a story form. And then if you even if you guys turn in your Bibles to chapter 3 and on, you'll notice it's kind of like indented like a poetry. And what's really interesting is the whole book there is pretty much in poetry form, Hebrew poetry. And I mean, for nothing else, like just the poetry is so beautiful and poetic. I encourage you guys to read it. But and some, you know, some commentators have said, oh, well, this can't be a real book because it's in poetry form. But I don't think that precludes it from being, you know, Job being a real person. And as we've already read in two of those other verses, you know, the people did uphold or did affirm that Job was a real person. But that's kind of how the book is laid out. And what's interesting in this book, too, is it uses the God name that's primarily used a lot of times is Shaddai. Okay, so you guys have heard the term El Shaddai, like God Almighty, essentially. And it's not used a whole lot in the Old Testament, 47 times, but 31 times is in this book. So there's a heavy emphasis on that. It doesn't really use the book or the word Yahweh, which if you guys have been here for Greg's sermon, you know, he's talking about Yahweh, which is the covenant God or the covenant name for God. So we see Shaddai a lot. And since we're in the wisdom literature, it's helpful to mention that in chapter 28, Job just talks all about wisdom. And I thought about going through that, but maybe if we have time, we can go back to that. But it's just really kind of a cool chapter on talking about wisdom and hear Job's thoughts on that. And so, but let's kind of get into the story a little bit here. The major characters in the book, God, Satan, Job, Job's three older friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, Zophar the Naamathite, and then later on, Job has a younger friend named Elihu, son of Barakel the Buzite. Okay, and if you guys have, let me ask this first, who has read the book of Job before? Okay, so most people are pretty familiar with the book, right? And you guys might, and this is something we'll probably briefly cover next week, is Elihu is the younger friend. We don't know where he comes in. Somehow, you know, he just starts speaking towards the end of the book. And if you guys know, at the end of the book, God condemns the three friends for speaking wrongly. But he doesn't condemn Elihu, so it's kind of a, what is different about Elihu's speech that is different from the rest of the people? And so we'll touch a little bit about that next week here. So this is the way I summarize the book in a few sentences, and again, this is, if you guys have read it before, you're very familiar with it, but let's just go ahead and I'll just read this here. It says, Job, a rich, God-fearing man, loses all he holds dear, and he and his friends try to make sense of what has happened. Job grieves, desponds, questions God, all the while maintaining his innocence, while his friends insist repeatedly he is being punished for his sin. When God finally speaks, he asks a series of rhetorical questions highlighting his majesty, and God is humbled, or Job, sorry, is humbled and repents of speaking with limited knowledge. God then reaffirms Job's uprightness, rebukes Job's friends, and blesses Job with more than he had before his calamity. That's kind of how I would sum it up. So, like I said in the beginning, we're going to mostly cover first three chapters. If we have time, we'll start actually bleeding into next week's lesson just to get a head start on that. So we'll mostly, again, focus on these three. And my subtitle there says Godly Response to Suffering and Comforting. So we'll kind of see how that plays out there. So we'll just read a lot of this and kind of discuss it, essentially. So Job chapter 1, 6 through 12. So I think I have, let's see here, Dee Dee reading that. So if we can turn there and read 6 through 12.
So Satan answered the Lord and said, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made it a hedge around him, around his household, and around all he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not lay a hand on his person. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord.
Thank you. So this is a really interesting encounter. If you guys have ever kind of thought about it, we get a behind-the-scenes look at what's going on here, right? We are privy to information that Job and his friends are not privy to. And have you ever thought about how does that change your view of Job's suffering? Like, if you didn't know any of this information, like, you know, how would you think about Job? Like, why he's suffering? I mean, maybe some of us would think, oh yeah, I kind of agree with the friends. He must have done something wrong. Why is he being punished, right? Is he being sinful? Is he paying for something of, you know, the consequences of his errors? What's going on, right? But this is a very unique behind the scenes look, like I said. And so just kind of important to know that a lot of times as we read this book, we might say, oh yeah, like his, you know, Job's friends are so wrong. How come they don't see this? But we forget that we are reading with the whole, we have extra information that they did not have, right? And I think just as a practical application to me is that there's a lot of behind the scenes things oftentimes that we are not aware of, right? There's a spiritual realm that when we go through things, we don't know what's going on. And we can forget that there are, there's a spiritual battle going on. So, but yeah, let's talk about here. So basically what is Satan's basic assertion to God? What is he saying to God?
Job's only upright because you blessed him.
Yeah, Job's only upright because you blessed him. So, sounds like it's a conditional thing, right? So basically, he's implying that if God, you didn't bless Job, he wouldn't worship you. And if you guys think about that, it's kind of like a double insult. He's actually insulting God and Job. He's saying, well, Job only really worships you because you give him things, and then insulting God, saying, well, God, you're really not worthy to be worshipped unless you do stuff for other people, right? And that's that. So it's kind of like a double insult here. And so God basically, you know, allows this to happen. So allows Satan to allow these calamities to fall upon him. And just kind of interesting thing, too, oftentimes we read here Satan, and in some versions will say the Satan, which is Satan is the word for adversary, or some people say the accuser. So like it's kind of like a courtroom battle here, you know. God is there and Satan comes in accusing and saying, well, these people. He's walking, you know, to the, he's not just taking a stroll on the earth, right? He's looking and ready to devour. And it kind of reminds me of 1 Peter 5:8, where it says the Satan prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. So that's kind of more of what this is saying here. Satan has been going to and fro from the earth. He's seeking to devour people, and he's accusing people before God. And God says, well, Job is upright. And so, so again, just a reminder of the spiritual realm that oftentimes is what we're dealing with when we're, well, there's always a spiritual realm that we may not see. Okay, so then this is kind of the behind the scenes happenings, and now we go on to what happens subsequent to this. So we'll read, we'll have Josiah read chapters 2. Just a sec. Hold on just a second here. Sorry. Actually, you know what? Oh, sorry. I missed the section here. I'll read chapter 1, verse 13 through 22. Okay. So there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and there came a messenger to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. When he was yet speaking, came another and said, the fire of God came from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, the Chaldeans formed three groups and made a raid on the camels and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And behold, a great wind came across the wilderness, struck the four corners of the house, and fell upon the young people, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. So what does Job lose here? What happens to him? Okay, that's a very good summary, right? So you guys see how things are back to back, right? So first, what, his sheep and servants, then camel and servants, and then children. It just, none of this stuff actually, you know, would have been completely, I guess, surprising, meaning it could have happened, but how back to back everything was what made it so crazy intense, is that it just, as soon as one servant was talking, it seemed like the next one came in and said it right after the other, right? And so this is the compound tragedy that made it so hard on Job. And you guys might have heard the saying, when it rains, it pours. Have you guys ever heard that? Some people say, ah, oh, this is a tough time. It seems like everything seems to go wrong. Like, Job ultimately suffered that. This is a really hard time for him. And what is Job's response, though, in the midst of all this? He worships God. Wow. Like, I don't know how many, that's kind of not what the normal human inclination would be, right? To worship God. Pretty wild. Any other things that we see in the verses I just read? Yeah. Yeah. So, I'm sorry? Yeah. Yeah, so that's a good observation, right? Like that he acknowledges God is the giver of things, but he may even acknowledge that God gave calamity, but he doesn't blame God for anything. He doesn't accuse God, right? And so, yeah. And let's not miss the human part of it too. He's grieving too, and he's, right? He tore his robe and he shaved his head and fell on the ground, and this is a common thing that people did if you read throughout the Old Testament or in the Bible, where people are grieving, they tear their robes and they shave their head and they're just mourning, right? And so he is obviously mourning. But he responds in a very, just say a very unhumanly characteristic, a very upright way, essentially. He worships God. So, if that weren't hard enough, we go to chapter 2, and that's even harder. So let's look at chapter 2 here. And so I'll have now Josiah can read chapter, and I got all my verses. Yeah, 2:1-10.
Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. The Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Satan answered, "The Lord said, I'm going to and fro along the earth, and walking up and down." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, blameless and upright man, fears God and turns away from evil, holds fast to his integrity, although you incited him against me, destroy him without reason?" Then Satan asked the Lord, saying, "He is all that a man has to do for his life. Stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, he will curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Behold, it is in your hands, only spare his life." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with blows from the swords, from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. He took a piece of broken pottery with which to scrape himself while he sat in the ash. His wife said to him, "You still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die." He said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women will speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil?" And all this Job did not sin with the lips.
Thanks. So, round two, very, if you guys notice, very similar outline, right, to the first time. I call it the Heavenly Council Court in part two. So what is this time Satan's accusations the second time? God said, "Hey, look, Job didn't, you know, Job is upright, right? And even though you incited me to allow you to do all these things, he still holds fast in integrity." So, of course, Satan, the accuser, has a retort, and what does he say? He's still alive? Okay, yeah. His health, right. Right, so he's like, yeah, Tim.
Like before he was saying, like you said, it's an insult to God. He's saying, like, "Oh, he really loves his stuff more than you, God." Mm. And now it's saying, okay, maybe not his stuff, but he at least loves his life more than you. Mm. Mm.
Yeah. So he deepens the accusation here. Yeah, at least his health, right? You can lose a lot of possessions, that's one thing, but to lose your own health, you know, some people say health is everything, right? And so, and what's interesting, he says, my ESV says skin for skin, right? Like flesh, basically. And so here, Satan afflicts Job's flesh. And he has all these sores, and he's kind of scraping himself. It's probably more for itchiness. It's just itchy, so he's using broken pottery to scratch himself. And he's probably sitting outside this, like kind of like the city dump almost, and he's just sitting out there and just loses his health. And so so let's see what happens here. Verses 7, so 7 through 10, he loses his health. And what else happens that is kind of an aggravation that also compounds this? Just say one of his relatives.
His wife is provoking.
Yeah, yeah. As if it weren't bad enough, right? His wife provokes him, and she's not telling him to worship God, right? She's saying, "Curse God and die," essentially. And it's almost like, look, your life is so terrible as it is. Why don't you just curse God and end it altogether? Let him curse you to the end, essentially. And so that must have been, just a bigger even blow to him. And yet, what is Job's response again this time?
Did not sin with his lips.
Okay, he did not sin with his lips. So what is that? What does that say? What is that? So what did he say or what did he not say?
He didn't blame God.
Okay, good. He didn't accuse God, yeah.
He seemed to recognize God has a... God did this, right? And that he said, shall he not take things away, but he doesn't accuse God of unrighteousness.
Mm-hmm. Right. And with the accusation from his wife, like how does he respond to that?
He really, with his statement, he's affirming God's sovereignty and wisdom and goodness, and he had the absolute right to do whatever he would do. He's not only not sinning against God with his lips, but he's affirming God's sovereignty and control.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, so his trust in God is steadfast, right? And just maybe I'll ask this now, but like, do you think, like, how could Job respond this way? I mean, honestly, like, how does someone just respond this way? How could he respond this way? I'll just put it that way. Can we respond that way? Yes, no, maybe so.
Every indication up to this point, we don't know the extent of it, but he's responding based on what he knows of God with the assumption that God's revealed himself. And so the extent of revelation that Job had is what he's responding according to in faith and what he knew of God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I guess, yeah, my point is, it's not like he, when the calamity came, he suddenly says, well, I better, you know, up my devotion to God, right? A lot of this stuff he had cultivated probably already from his life, that he had already been upright, and he had already worshipped God, and he had heard things from God and probably rehearsed things from God. And so it's not like just when we go through suffering, a lot of it is when suffering just brings out essentially what our probably deepest held beliefs are about God. Is that, you know, makes sense for you guys, that, right? It evokes basically what is in our hearts. And so suffering is a lot of times a revealing of what we hold dear and what our thoughts are about God. And so, yeah, so Job, you know, again, his character was upright before all this, and that's why he could respond to this. Now, this does kind of change a little bit, of course, you know, as he goes through suffering and starts processing through all this. Not to say he doesn't become upright, but there are certain changes in the way he starts thinking. And so we'll kind of see a little bit of that today and then towards next week also. Okay, so then this is the way that Job responds. And then now we have some friends coming into the picture. So Brian will read for us verses 11 through 13 of chapter 2.
Now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that had come upon him, they came each from his own place, Nephus, Timnai, Bilhah, Bildad, Shittite, Zophar, the Namanite. They made an appointment together to come to show him sympathy and comfort him. and when they saw him from a distance, they did not recognize him, and they raised their voices and wept, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads towards heaven. And yet they sat with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great.
All right, great. So we have these three friends entering the picture, and so how do they respond to Job's suffering, at least at this point, when they first enter this picture here? They come to him, yeah. That's good. That's a good thing, right? They hear, they come. What was that?
Showing sympathy, the comfort.
Yeah, they show him sympathy. How do they demonstrate that? Yeah. Right, right. Yeah, they tore their own robes. They kind of, you know, they're just very in anguish themselves. Yeah. What else? Did you say something, Jeff?
They cried.
Yeah, they cried. They cried with him. They cried for him. Yeah. Yeah, Spencer.
Sat in silence.
Sat in silence, yeah. What do you think about that, sitting in silence? Is that comforting? Yeah. Right? Some people would argue that this is probably should have did more of this later on, you know. Instead of, once they start speaking, it starts going downhill pretty quickly. So some have said, yeah, that's sometimes the most helpful thing. But, yeah, they do all these different things, right? At this point, it seems like they're true friends. I mean, let's not forget that. They come, they make an appointment together, right? They say, hey, guys, you know, let's all come and comfort Job, right? So there's indication that they go and to meet with him, and they sit with him outside the city and basically mourn with him and grieve with him. And so they are showing comfort to him. And so maybe I can just pause here and say, if anybody wants to share here, when you guys have gone through a tough time, let's just say in your life, what have been maybe some of the most helpful ways that other people have comforted you, and maybe what are some of the ways that were not helpful? Just to kind of put this into a little perspective here and a little application, if anybody feels comfortable sharing. Yeah, Lori. Mm-hmm.
And physical means. The most unhelpful thing is assigning God's motives to it. Well, maybe God didn't want you to have this, or maybe He wants to teach you this.
Mm-hmm.
Those kinds of things.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Because we don't know that, right? Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anybody else? Yeah, Paul. I think it means a lot to just, yeah, have friends to have access to, whether it be, you know, calling or just people. I think it's one thing to have friends that you can call and contact and things like that, but just others that take the initiative to do that, right, to come. And maybe as an encouragement for us that if we take the initiative and go out to them and mourn with them, and as Lori said, it's probably not helpful to just say, well, Romans 8:28, you know, God works all things out. And that might be true. Maybe there's a time to say that, but there's times to also grieve with them, kind of understand what they're feeling, and maybe at times just being there, maybe giving them a hug and just not even offering too much counsel. It might seem like you're helpless, not be able to offer very much, but oftentimes that itself is worth a lot, I think. And so I think that's a good lesson for us. Any other ones? Basically, if we want to... Yeah, Jeff.
Yeah, it's just that empathy is, I think, a good... It's beneficial just having someone that can, like, feel your
things are going through, and that's what his friends did initially. That, you know, was, you know, they were comforting, they were quiet and silent, but they were empathizing with what he had just gone through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Paula. Oh.
Also, that they empathize with you, but not make you feel guilty because of your suffering, saying, "Oh, look what you have. Mm-hmm. You have this, you have that. God, why are you sad?"
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Got from Tim earlier that says, you know, when you're suffering, you kind of feel like a loser, and you don't want to say that, but you know there's something different about you, right? And so you already have a sense of you feel a difference between you and the world already, and so there's a sense of that. And so to have friends that make you not feel worse, that, you know, you're already feeling aloof, right? There's already a gap, whether it be your health issues, whether it be financial issues, and so if someone just compounds that, that's very, very hard. But to people to kind of to walk you through that and say, hey, this is kind of part of the universal experience, essentially. I mean, when you feel like you're suffering, a lot of times you feel like you're the only person that's going through this, or no one can fully understand what you're going through. And that may or may not be true, but that's kind of how often it feels. So, yeah. Okay. All right, well, let's spend a little bit of time in Job 3 now. So Job is, after a full week, he opens his mouth now. And so we'll hear the first words that basically come out of his mouth. And as we mentioned earlier, this is kind of going into the poetic form, which I really love, but just Job is starting to talk here. And so let me read. So basically, yeah, if there was a point 6 on your outline, I would have said this is Job's first speech. Okay, so sorry, I kind of ran out of space and I wasn't sure how much we'd cover. But so point 6 would be basically Job's first speech. Okay, so I'll read the first, and I'll read the first 13 verses. Okay, so we'll hear. But after this, Job opened his mouth, cursed the day of his birth, and Job said, "Let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said a man is conceived. Let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor light shine upon it. Let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let clouds dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. That night, let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the numbers of the months. Behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful cry enter it. Let those curse it who curse the day, who are ready to rouse up Leviathan. Let the stars of its dawn be dark, and let it hope for light, but have none, nor see the eyelids of the morning, because it did not shut the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide trouble from my eyes. Why did I not die at birth, come out from the womb and expire? Why did the knees receive me, or why the breast that I should nurse? For then I would have laid down and been quiet. I would have slept, and I would have been at rest." Okay, so, and then kind of keeps going on for a few more verses there. But what do you get from just even from these verses, whether it be his mood, what he's saying, like what's going on now as he's talking?
In a broad sense, he's lamenting. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Among other things.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. He's lamenting. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Both of you guys said the same thing. Yeah. He's wishing he's never born. Right. So he's in such grief. He's saying, "Oh, it would have been better if I were never born." Right. And even the first verse, it says he cursed the day of his birth. Okay. So that sounds like pretty strong. But notice what he does not curse. Like, what does he not curse? God, right? He's not cursing God. And in a sense, somewhat, he's not really cursing himself directly either. He is cursing that, you know, his circumstances. He's saying, "I kind of wish this never happened to me, and if I had not been born, it wouldn't have happened," right? He's not saying, "I am a terrible person, I'm a wicked person." He's not cursing himself, but he's just cursing the day he was born. And so he's just in such grief here that he is cursing that. And if you guys notice here, there's a lot of processing, as Greg says, well, lamenting. He's asking questions, right? And so a lot of times we ask questions, kind of like I started off the lesson with, why did this happen? So if you look at verse 11, why did I not die at birth, right? Verse 16, why was I not hidden as a stillborn child? 20, why is light given to him who is in misery and life to the bitter soul? 23, why is light given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? So he's just asking, why God, why does this all happen to me? So he's just trying to process out loud, essentially, of all these different things. And so he's lamenting, he's processing, and then his friends are going to say stuff very soon. And so I think next, so we still have a little time, but I'm just going to kind of bring us where we're going to go to next week and give a little bit of preview. So on the, if you guys look on the last page there, it will give kind of the rest of the book. And essentially what's going to happen is there's going to be almost three full cycles of discourses with his friends. So he has a friend, Eliphaz is going to talk, Job's going to respond. Bildad's going to talk, Job's going to respond. Zophar's going to talk, Job's going to respond. And this happens almost three full cycles. Zophar doesn't speak a third time, but basically it's going to happen boom, 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 just one after the other. And so we kind of can see as time goes on, and just kind of a spoiler alert, it gets worse. Basically, there first it becomes, well, maybe you did some wrong, you should repent. And then second all, he said, well, you probably did, you did wrong. And then eventually he goes, you are an evil person, essentially. It starts becoming that way. And so it's a very sobering way to read through that, just how quickly it degrades. And so those are the three cycles of friends. And then right after those three friends, like I mentioned, there's this mystery guy, Elihu, who comes in. He's a younger friend. And he basically has this five chapter discourse that is the longest of anybody's in there. And there have been, again, controversies of, was he wrong? Was he right? Because a lot of things he says sounds very, very similar to what the other people, other three say. And if you guys have time this week, I encourage you guys to, you know, if you can read through the whole book of Job if you want. So, you know, it takes about an hour or so. But that will be, we'll see a little bit about what makes Elihu's speech different. And then, of course, after Elihu speaks, God then answers Job. And he basically asks a bunch of questions. Job, were you this? You know, were you here when I did this? Can you do this? Can you do this? Right? And Job's mindset is basically reset and broadened and said, oh, yeah, I spoke of things I did not know. But even through all this processing, we can see Job's kind of fluctuating. At times he seems to be exalting God. Sometimes he seems to be asking why. He's sometimes lamenting. Sometimes he's praising God. So there is a very real sense that when people are in suffering, they kind of go through all these different moods. You know, sometimes a little bit anger, a little disappointment, a little bit, oh, God is to be praised, right? And so it's another picture of the human experience of when we go through suffering. And I think it's really important to realize that, and it's cool to see that, because it's not like Job was just, you know, very like, oh, God is righteous and God is sovereign, and just goes through the whole book that way. There are times when he asks, why, God, why did this happen? You know, curse, God, why was I born? I don't understand this. What's going on? And so there is an encouragement from that even a righteous man, you know, we want to know. And eventually what we're going to find out is the question, again, another spoiler alert, is that God never answers why Job is suffering, right? Like, a lot of times we want answers why. Like, why did this happen? But the real deeper question is God just, right? But that's actually the underlying question. It's like, if Job was innocent, why did he suffer? So the underlying question is, well, if he suffered, does that God make just or unjust, right? And people want to know that. And so that there is an answer to that. And of course, we know that God is just in all of it. And so that's often the deeper question. Is God a just God or not? So I'll just pause there. Any questions thus far? kind of covered a decent amount today, and kind of where we're going with that. So, yeah, Tim.
Just a quick question back there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
El Shaddai, yeah, the Almighty. I think, to me, I'm just thinking, this is just off the cuff here, but basically kind of what Josh brought up, you know, theodicy oftentimes is not only, okay, is God, so the question usually goes like this, and you guys might have heard this, is if God is all-loving and all-powerful, you know, why, and there's, okay, so if God is loving, that means he's, that can't tolerate evil, and God is all powerful, which means he can do anything. But then the fact that evil exists, that means, wait a second, if evil exists, then how come is God either not all powerful because he could get rid of it, or he's not all loving, right? And he's choosing not to get rid of it. And so that's often how the question is posed, even though we know that's not a true dichotomy, but you know, there's some answers to that if you guys want to talk about that later. But so I think we get the answer in this. In this book about God being just and, of course, being loving, but he's all powerful too. And so I think we see here that God can do all things, and that's just part of God's character that is addressed and kind of focused. Does that make sense? Yeah, in this book. You guys ever? Oh, go ahead, Paul. No, I was just saying if anybody, you guys have ever wrestled or even talked with maybe unbelievers or had that kind of discussion of. If God is loving, powerful, why is there evil in this world? And how have you guys responded, if you guys want to share? You know, that's, it's a hard question, right? It's kind of dealing with that. So I don't expect an elaborate answer, but just kind of curious, because it seems like that's kind of the big question, especially during hard times, right? After 9/11 or after just a dear friend's or a dear family member's death, they often people will ask you that, and I think it's good to have a response to know what to say to that. Yeah, Paul, you want to say?
Yeah, I guess I was just curious that you were studying also if you sign the parallel and when it's connecting kind of Job. Because it seems like it's really clear in all that he did, he's not sin with his lips. And then kind of like you, I'm reading my own devotion from Isaiah, especially if you should see, you know, like there's statements like that. He did not open up his mouth, he did not sin with his lips, he did not. It's like there's like these parallels, and obviously he's suffering. But also later on, I was just curious if you had an answer, like, is complaining okay? Because, you know, sometimes Psalms, I'll say, God, I bring my complaints before you. So that's what I feel like maybe we just say it's okay to complain sometimes to God and bring, and it's not necessarily sinning with your lips, but you still kind of expressing your, you know, frustration with those complaints.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so there's a few questions in there, but yeah, I mean, if you look at, I think a lot of the Psalms, right, David is pouring out his heart, and so I think they're there again to, I mean, we're human, God knows that, God has given, we're his children, and so we often like, I mean, for those that are parents, I hear, you know, you want your kids to come to you and to kind of just be honest and pour out your heart before them. I think when it becomes sinful, obviously, if you start accusing of, you know, God of injustice or accusing him of not being loving, I think it's not wrong to say, God, like, why? This is hard. This terrible. This sucks. I don't like this. And just to pour out. And I think that's human. And I think that's appropriate. And so I think that's fine. And then I think your first part about, I think there's, let's not forget. Yeah. A lot of the Old Testament points to Christ. Right. And so, Jesus himself was the greater Job, if you want to put it that way. And a lot of the Old Testament, even the upright people, were not sinless, right? But Jesus was the ultimate sinless one. He was the ultimate one that did not deserve suffering. He was the ultimate one that got the worst calamity, if you want to say, of all. But he shows how to respond properly, right? So Job, even in his uprightness, does say certain things that, of course, God essentially kind of rebukes in saying, like, well, you kind of went a little bit too far. You didn't have the full knowledge of, or you lost sight of the knowledge of who I was. But basically, pointing to Jesus, he never lost sight of who God was. He always submitted to the will of the Father. He knew. But he did himself, right? Like, God, you know, why have you forsaken me? Some would say that's a complaint. Well, it's showing the anguish of his soul, right? And so I think it's appropriate to pour out our souls to God. But yeah, I think we should also, yeah, remember Job, yeah, ultimately does magnify the Christ later on, as he is the one that ultimately did not open his mouth to sin, right? And no sin or deceit was found in his mouth, as he said. So, yeah. Any other comments before we close? Okay, well, thanks, Enon. I'll just close with a word of prayer, and we'll continue next week, and we will cover a lot of material, but I look forward to it. And you know, again, it's not going to take super long, even though it's 39 chapters, because a lot of the Job's friend's speeches and his speech can be summed up, you know, briefly. And so we'll just kind of condense those, and I'll kind of give you guys the highlights of what is being said. So let's close in a word of prayer here. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for this day. And again, we praise you. God, you are all-loving. God, you are just, and you are almighty and powerful. And you know what we do not. God, you plan all things according to your good will and for the good of your children. Lord, help us. Oftentimes we go through hard times, God, either with ourselves or a dear loved one, and it's hard to see and hard to understand, but help us to have the right view of your sovereignty. Help us to be good comforters to those who are suffering, and to be careful of ascribing what we do not know. God, help us to be aware and remember there is a spiritual realm. We have an accuser. We have Satan who daily accuses us before the Father. And yet we thank you that we have a great high priest, Jesus Christ, who advocates for us and who declares us blameless because of his blood and not our own works. And so we pray we would look to Christ and delight in that. Yes, God, we thank you for forgiving us of him, Lord. And we just pray for this week and this coming day, and we thank you for your sovereignty and your goodness, and thank you for your scriptures. Bless the rest of this morning. In your name we pray. Amen.